This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Native American women are much more likely to be the victims of violence than the general American population. It's grown into a full-blown crisis. It's being called an epidemic of missing and murdered indigenous women. The statistics are sobering. President Trump pointed to them last fall when he unveiled an executive order aimed at tackling the problem.
One study showed that Native American women in certain tribal communities are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the average American. The victims and their families deserve action, and this should have happened many years ago.
That action comes in the form of a cold case offices opening across the country this month that will focus on unsolved crimes involving indigenous victims. One such office is opening Wednesday in Anchorage, Alaska. We'll hear from the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs about that later on in today's show. But first, let's learn more about one of those unsolved cases. Kaysera Stops Pretty Places was found dead a year ago, not far from the Crow Reservation in Montana where she grew up. Her aunt, Grace Boldhill, joins us now. Grace, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for speaking with me.
What happened after Kaysera went missing? That was August 24th, 2019. It was only 10 days after her 18th birthday.
Kaysera was in Hardin, which is a border town in southeastern Montana. She was reported missing by a relative. A missing persons report was never filed for her. On August 29th, a body was discovered, and it went unidentified for 2 weeks. And on September 11th, we were told that Kaysera had been identified. And she had in fact been found on August 29th. And our family still has no answers as to why it took so long to identify her. And even after she was identified, no one in our family was interviewed.
Were you able to learn anything about the circumstances surrounding her death?
We haven't been able to get much information from law enforcement in Bighorn County. We are constantly dismissed at every level of the justice system. We have asked the Montana Attorney General, Tim Fox, who is also from Hardin, Bighorn County, to speak to us. We don't feel that her case is adequately being investigated. There's just many circumstances that we feel we need more information, and really we've been left to do our own investigations.
How are you going about doing that investigation?
Sure. So I have reached out to Kaysera's friends. I was able to find teenagers that she was close with. And actually someone that was last seen with her. And if I hadn't found that out myself, I definitely wouldn't have heard that from the investigators who have told no details to anyone in my family. And the neighborhood that Kaysera was found in she was at a house right next door to a yard that she was found in. And we're told that she had been in that yard for 5 days, which is the length of time that we believe she was deceased. And really, myself and my family had to figure this out myself. And we have had no luck in getting answers, you know, really having any faith that an investigation is being done. It's pretty obvious that, you know, there's evidence that she was in the area, she was with certain people. And it's been just really disheartening to see. And now that it's coming up on a year that she went missing, I am protesting at the spot where she was found in Hardin. I will remain here until the 29th. We had a vigil last night, and you know, we're just trying to do everything we can so that we can be heard and that we can seek justice for Kaycera.
Grace, can you tell us more about Kaycera and who she was?
Kaycera was extremely active. She was a great athlete. She was involved in basketball, football, wrestling, running. She was raised by several family members. My grandparents and myself raised her, and she was part of several tribal communities, the Crow and Northern Cheyenne, here in southeastern Montana. And she was very beloved by her large extended families. She wanted to be an actress, a performer. She was, always surrounded by many friends, and it has been one comfort to me to be able to speak to her friends and, just to hear their stories about her. And several of them came to the vigil service for her yesterday, and just to know that she had touched so many people.
As we mentioned before, this violence affects so many Native American families. As you're talking to them, as you're sharing your stories, what's emerging as being some of the root of why these cases are going unsolved?
I think in Bighorn County in particular, a lot of the problem is when young women, teenagers in Kaycera's case, go missing, they're not treated as a priority by law enforcement, in who should be charged with taking their missing persons report seriously and going into action immediately. I've also found that the narrative quickly turns to victim blaming, such as, well, the woman is at fault. The woman or girl is at fault for what happened to her. She shouldn't have been, involved in these activities. She shouldn't have been out with friends. Really saying that she shouldn't have been behaving as a teenager. And that's very much the narrative that I see commonly occurring in this area.
That's Grace Boltel, the aunt of Kaycera Stops Pretty Places, joining us from Montana. Grace, thank you so much for speaking with us, and I really, I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
You can learn more about her case by searching for Justice for Kaycera, that's Kaycera, on Facebook or Twitter. And we do want to mention that we've reached out to the Bighorn County Attorney and will update the story as needed. You can go to the1a.org for updates and more information. Next, we'll hear from experts about why so many Indigenous women are going missing and what can be done about it. Damon commented on Facebook, Native American people experience this type of crime at a rate far greater than any other group and then experience complete neglect by law enforcement. So yes, it is about her community and her background. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
I'm Jen White. We're talking about the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. According to the FBI, nearly 5,600 Native American women were reported missing last year. And according to the Urban Indian Health Institute, murder is the third leading cause of death among American Indigenous women. Here to tell us why is Margot Hill. She's a member of the Spokane Tribe, where she formerly served as tribal attorney. She now teaches at Eastern Washington University and directs the school's tribal planning program. Margot, welcome to 1A.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Eureka, California, is Anita Lucchese. She's the executive director of the Sovereign Bodies Institute, which tracks cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. She's a Cheyenne descendant. Anita, it's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Anita, we just heard about the unsolved murder of Kaysera Stopp's Pretty Places. How common are stories like hers?
Unfortunately, Kaysera's story is very common. I've been fortunate to get to work with Kaysera's Aunt Grace, who we heard from earlier, as well as other members of Kaysera's family and other families in the region. It's important to know that Kaysera is one of 32 cases of missing and murdered Native women and girls in Bighorn County, and one of 62 cases in southeastern Montana. So while her story is heartbreaking in so many ways, it's part of a broader landscape of injustice, not just in Montana. We've documented over 4,000 cases of missing and murdered Native women and girls throughout the U.S. and Canada.
Over what period of time?
Well, we document from 1900 to the present, but over 80% of that data is post-1980, not necessarily because the violence is increasing, but because the data is so hard to access. So the easier or the more present you get, the easier it is to gather.
Margot, can you explain how the prosecution of crimes works on tribal land and how that relates to this crisis?
Yes. The complicated jurisdictional scheme in Indian country makes it very difficult to protect Native women. There are a number of factors that come into play. Federal Indian policies like the Allotment Act opened up reservation lands, so we had more non-Indians settlers coming onto the reservation. We have statutes and United States Supreme Court cases. But what it comes down to is a number of factors. It depends on the land tenure. It is the property where the act was committed. It matters. Is it trust property owned by a tribe, or is it fee property? And then it also matters who is the perpetrator. Are they Native or non-Native? This determines who has jurisdiction. And then lastly, there are statutes like the Major Crime Act. If it's a major crime like murder, rape, arson, then the feds come in and do the prosecutions. So then we're dependent upon federal actors who are responsible to prosecute these crimes. You have FBI agents that come onto the reservation, and you have the U.S. Attorney's Office that prosecute these violent crimes. And the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't always prosecute these crimes. I served as the tribe's attorney for over 10 years, and I can tell you I received letters of declination where they declined to prosecute very violent crimes on our reservations.
When you were Spokane Tribal Attorney, can you give us an example of a case you worked on or you followed so that we have a better idea of how this works in real time when you're trying to solve one of these cases?
Okay. So there's a whole range of cases. It goes from, molestation of young Indian children, where we worked with Casey family partners to have forensic interviews. We worked really hard to have good cases for the U.S. attorneys to prosecute, and they would decline to prosecute. Sometimes they were more violent acts of sexual assault and sodomy, those cases weren't prosecuted. I can tell you now the U.S. Attorney's Office is working to prosecute cases, but for many years, Indian country was ignored.
How much investigation goes into cases like Kaysera's, which is right now it's a mysterious death. It hasn't been called a murder. As I said, the autopsy wasn't able to hone into a cause of death. But how much investigation actually goes into these cases?
Well, it's difficult to say. Whenever there's a domestic violence or a homicide, we have to rely on our outside partners. If it's a domestic violence and it's a non-native, we do not have criminal jurisdiction over those individuals. There's a United States Supreme Court case, Oliphant, that states tribes have no criminal jurisdiction. So we have to rely on a local county sheriff to come on and do investigations or to do the investigation for a simple DV. And again, if it's a major crime, we are calling FBI agents. They can be very hard to solve because we can't get anybody to come out to the reservation. Or as was mentioned by the aunt, it's just not a priority.
So just to be clear, if an act of violence is committed against a woman on tribal land by someone who is not part of the tribe, you're limited in the degree to which you can actually prosecute that person, except for in specific cases of domestic violence. Is that accurate?
So, yes, and it's very complicated. Not even in acts of domestic violence. In the past, we had TLOA, the Tribal Law and Order Code Act, that expanded the punitive abilities of tribal courts across the nation. But tribal courts are very limited in scope of what they can punish, what they can hand down as far as punitive measures. So we're treated like the impression is given that we're a lower, less serious court. And that causes a lot of challenges for tribal governance, for tribal communities to protect their women and children, for that matter. There's, a range of violence against women and children, whether you're on the reservation or you're even in the urban areas. It's difficult. These investigations don't always happen because of the stereotypes. There's victim blaming, as was mentioned. Oh, she, there's allegations of drug use. When we seen here in the city of Spokane that there was somebody, an indigenous woman that was found in an alleyway, and she didn't use drugs at all. And she later died of her assault wounds.
Anita, your organization maintains a database that logs all the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women since 1900, you said. What have you learned through your collection of that data?
I think one of the most powerful things that we've learned from the data is that there really is no place that hasn't been touched by this violence. I think a lot of the media coverage of this issue has focused on places like Montana or Arizona, New Mexico, and it absolutely happens at horrifically high rates in those areas, for sure. But we're also seeing it in places like California. The county where I live in California actually has the same number of cases as southwestern Montana. And so that's something that's completely left out of the national narrative. I think one of the other really striking findings from the data is the high incident rate of police violence and death in custody. We've documented over 100 cases of police brutality that ultimately led to death of Native women or girls. So there's this kind of initial number or quantification of police brutality. But then as we start doing deep dives with families on their loved ones' cases, what we're seeing is the same issues that Caseras families have experienced in terms of negligence, abuse by the system, bizarre actions taken by coroners. This is something that happens constantly, and especially in areas where a case is county jurisdiction, like Caseras is, or in California, which is a public law 280 state, which means that county sheriffs have jurisdiction over Indian reservations rather than the FBI. What we see in those areas is that there's just a certain lack of accountability in law enforcement. And when you think about it, a county sheriff is an elected official, that has pretty much no accountability to the people that elect them, because as private citizens, we're not We don't have access to 99% of what he does on a daily basis. And so those sheriffs can act with a certain level of impunity. And we see that when we talk to the families. Sovereign Bodies Institute just released a report on missing and murdered Native women and girls of Northern California. And we have a whole chapter on police violence. What was really difficult to hear was that every family had a story of rape at the hands of a non-Native police officer.
We're talking about violence towards Native women with Eastern Washington University Assistant Professor Margo Hill and Anita Lucchese, Executive Director of the Sovereign Bodies Institute. I'm Jen White. How can Indigenous women fight back? We'll talk more after the break.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. And before we move on, I want to mention that if you or someone you know needs help, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a domestic and sexual violence hotline for American Indians and Alaskan Natives. It's anonymous and it's confidential. That number is 1-844-762-8483. And the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233. Last fall, President Trump signed an executive order that created Operation Lady Justice. That's a task force with the goal of improving law enforcement's response to cases of missing and murdered American Indians and Alaskan Natives. We'll talk more with our guests shortly about the crisis of violence against Indigenous women specifically. But first, let's listen to a conversation I had yesterday with the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, Tara Sweeney, who's an Alaska Native. I began by asking her about how Operation Lady Justice plans to accomplish its goal.
One of the initiatives is opening cold case offices across the country, which has never been done before, a focus for Native Americans who have fallen victim to murder or have gone missing. The first office was opened in Bloomington, Minnesota on July 27, and we had the pleasure of having advisor to the president, Ivanka Trump, and Secretary Bernhardt attend that opening as the first cold case office opened in the country. From Bloomington, we opened an office in Rapid City, South Dakota, Billings, Montana, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Phoenix, Arizona. On Wednesday, we will open the Anchorage, Alaska office, and then sometime in September, we're aiming to open the final office in Nashville, Tennessee.
And you mentioned Secretary Bernhardt, that's Secretary of the Interior, correct?
Yes, Secretary of the Interior, David Bernhardt.
So how will these cold case offices actually work and interact with communities?
These cold case offices will work through the multi-jurisdictional layers that we see challenging so many of our communities, whether there is an overlap in federal jurisdiction with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the FBI or the local county sheriff's office or tribal law enforcement. The important thing to remember is that these cold case offices will be gathering intelligence on active missing cases, reviewing and prioritizing those cases for assignments to investigative teams, and then developing the investigative plan to help guide those involved in these investigations, and then looking to identify any outside resources that could benefit their investigative efforts.
So when you talk about additional resources, does that include additional financial resources that might be needed?
I think it runs the gamut. We all have a role to play. And where the Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Justice Services, as the leader of this initiative within the Operation Lady Justice Task Force, is assigning resources and assigning special agents to each location. In addition to that, Congress has a role to play, and that is to use their plenary powers of the purse to help aid in this effort across the country.
Some members of tribal communities say that Operation Lady Justice isn't addressing some of the root causes of violence against women. You mentioned the opioid crisis, but they point to things like the pipelines approved by President Trump that run through tribal territories and bring in outsiders. How are you responding to their concerns?
Well, when you need to take a look at the directives in the executive order. When a task force is created, the duties of the task force are outlined in the executive order. And so for the Operation Lady Justice Task Force under Executive Order 13898, again, I want to underscore that the Trump administration has taken and will continue to take the necessary steps to make our communities safer. The critical concerns that have been raised throughout the listening sessions and the tribal consultations are very, very important. They help guide our internal task force discussions on the recommendations that we will be making to the president. The president signed the executive order. He also declared May 5th as Missing and Murdered American Indian and Alaska Native Awareness Day. We continue to lead the Opioid Reduction Task Force at DOI, and now what you're seeing is more action with addressing the cold case office openings.
Again, I've read the executive order, and I think the concerns I'm hearing are more about some of the preventative issues people are concerned about. I think the opioid crisis is one that you're pointing to. But when they're talking about issues like pipelines, about how tribal territories are being open to outsiders and how that increases violence against women, is the task force able to address those issues? Because this is an incredibly complex issue, as you've said.
So the task force has two major deliverables to the president. The first is to provide a status update that is due in November of this year to the president, and then to provide a final report at the end of 2021 with recommendations. How advocacy groups and community advocates can engage in this process is to make their voice heard through the consultations that we are hosting. Raising those issues on the calls, we've had to switch to a virtual delivery or virtual engagement with Indian Country and Alaska Native communities due to COVID. And we're determined to continue to provide an opportunity for those advocates who are concerned about issues that may be outside of the executive order, providing them an opportunity to share those concerns with the task force.
Assistant Secretary Sweeney, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for allowing me to participate today. I really appreciate it.
Now back to our guests, Eastern Washington University Assistant Professor Margot Hill and Anita Lucchese, Executive Director of the Sovereign Bodies Institute. Margot, I'll come to you first. What do you make of the Trump administration's efforts to address this crisis?
So we really appreciate the fact that Operation Lady Justice is creating a cold case task force. But really, more needs to happen. We need resources for our tribal law enforcement. We need more resources for our tribal court systems. And we need jurisdiction back with tribal courts. You know, we are sometimes less protected, and we're less likely to bring some of these abductors and predators to justice. If you look at some of the requirements, there's paternalistic restrictions on tribal courts, and it goes beyond those that are imposed on state courts. In legal communities, we have something called comity, where one court recognizes the orders of another court. So our tribal court restraining orders and protection orders really need to be recognized by other courts. So you need the tribal courts to have the jurisdiction and authority and really the power to protect Indigenous women.
We've gotten a couple of questions in. Michael sent us this email asking, how does the number of murdered and or missing Indigenous women compare to the number of murdered or missing U.S. women more broadly? Anita?
I think that's a challenging question to answer. One of the things that I like to remind people is that all of the things that we're asking for in terms of system changes to better track cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, those are things that benefit women in other communities as well. Frankly, the data collection systems that exist are underserving every population, but especially women of color. I know that there's been a national dialogue on missing and murdered Black women as well. There's similarly very poor data on the violence that they experience too. So it's not that we're, as Native people, unique in not being counted properly. It's that the system is broken, doesn't work effectively, and that we're more likely to fall through some of those cracks because of our political status as Native people.
We also got this email from Toby who says, the numbers of missing and murdered Indigenous boys and men is as high or higher than that for girls and women. Is this being overlooked? Anita, can you give us any insight into that?
It definitely, there is a crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous men and boys. And one thing I want to clarify about SBI's data is that we include all Two-Spirit people. Two-Spirit is a Native word for folks who fall on the LGBT spectrum. So regardless of whether they identify as a man or a woman or as non-binary, if they're on the LGBT spectrum, they're included in our data. That said, there are also cis and straight Indigenous men and boys that go missing and are murdered as well. There is a critical lack of data on that issue, and we've started working to address it, but know that we need help in that process. Our database stretches from Canada all the way down to Argentina, so we can't count every missing and murdered Native person in two continents. That's a lot, but we're always willing to support other people in tracking that data and teaching them how we collect ours so that we can support that critical work.
Margot, can you talk briefly about the legislation currently in Congress that's aimed at trying to address this crisis?
Okay. Yeah, there's been a number of really important legislation that's gone forward. First, we've seen Savannah's Act, a federal bill that required law enforcement to track and report data. The bill was essentially blocked by one vote. Bob Goodlatte of Virginia opposed certain provisions. And that bill directs Department of Justice to review, revise, and develop law enforcement and justice protocols to help address missing and murdered Native Americans, and it also provides training and technical assistance to tribes and law enforcement. More recently, we have the Not Invisible Act. U.S. Congresswoman Deborah Holland introduced this bill really to increase government coordination, identify and combat violent crime within Indian country, establish a committee to find solutions, and reduce violent crimes in Indian country. We need to support our tribal judges, support our survivors that have been trafficked, support our tribal law enforcement, and really support family members of murdered, missing Indigenous women, girls, and all Natives, and develop and recommend best practices. Those are some of the intentions of the committee that would be developed under the Not Invisible Act.
Anita, just as we wrap in these final few seconds, what more would you like to see from within tribal communities to address this issue?
Well, I think tribal communities have shown remarkable power and resilience on this issue, and it's one of the few things that really organizes us and brings us together. So if anything, I'm really proud of the work that all of our communities have undertaken and continue to do. I guess what I would like to stress to listeners is that you don't have to be Native to get involved in this issue. You don't have to live on a reservation to have this issue affect you. This happens in every corner of this country, and it's going to take all of us to fix it. We have an organizing toolkit available on our website for free, so if you're looking for ways to get involved, please check that out.
That's Anita Lucchese, the executive director of the Sovereign Bodies Institute, and Margo Hill, the former Spokane tribal attorney. She now teaches at Eastern Washington University and directs the school's tribal planning program. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.